Johnny, I know you're really excited about this interview with Dr. Warren Farrell.
I had picked up his book, The Boy Crisis, and it was phenomenal. And the data and research that went into it certainly paints a story that we all need to pay attention to.
Pretty eye-opening.
Hey, this is The Art of Charm,
a podcast dedicated to bringing you actionable tips and strategies on how to boost your emotional intelligence, connect socially, and master conversation. I'm AJ.
And I'm Johnny. Today we're airing part two of our Parenthood series, a series where we talk about parts of parenthood that frankly aren't talked about in our culture openly.
Last month, we focused on motherhood with Dr. Alexandra Sachs, who unpacked a fascinating term called matrescence, which turned our idea of motherhood on its head a little. And to hear it, head on over to episode 760 to check it out.
On the heels of Father's Day, we are, of course, taking a look at fatherhood.
And our guest is Dr. Warren Farrell, the author of several books, including Why Men Are the Way They Are and The Myth of Male Power. And of course, most recently, The Boy Crisis. His background is in political and social science with a focus on couples communication and fatherhood. And Johnny, you've been wanting to get Warren on the show for a while. How'd you get turned on to Warren's material?
Well, in this space, a lot of what we hear about the young men that come through is quite alarming. And I wanted to get some more research and understand our clients better. And Warren's book certainly helped me with that.
Well, I'm eager to learn what the boy crisis is and how fatherhood has changed since we were kids, because it has, and correct me if I'm wrong, Johnny, Warren has been studying this change.
He certainly has. And as we know, everything has changed since we were young because of the technology involved. And certainly that technology is going to play a role in fatherhood as well.
Next week, we have a reminder, is our Q&A episode with us and Michael Harold, one of our coaches here at The Art of Charm. If you have questions, send them over. It's easy. Go to theartofcharm.com/questions, or you can hit us up on Instagram at theartofcharm. Obviously, the title, The Boy Crisis, is shocking on its face. What made you decide to sit down and write about such an important issue?
Well, I was going around the world sort of speaking on my other books on book tours, and a teacher in Japan, I remember once, came up to me and she said, you know, Dr. Farrell, you know, we have more problems with boys in our class in schools, and you know, all over Japan, we're having problems with the boys more than the girls. And then I started to see that in all 56 developed nations, boys were falling behind girls on every single academic subject, especially reading and writing, which are the two biggest predictors of success. And so I said, developed nations, what do developed nations have in common? And I realized that they had in common, they had enough mastery over survival that they could be more, give more permission for two things. One is for divorce, and the other one is for children to be raised by single moms if a single mom chose to do so. And so I started looking within those two groups of populations, and those two demographics, the boys that were having the problems were the ones that were children of divorce who had minimal or no contact with their dads. And so that I saw that the boy crisis resides where dads do not reside. This seemed sad, but I also know, I have a PhD in political science, and I knew a lot about history. And so I knew that the Moynihan Report in 1965 had found that, you know, when they studied inner city crime and why children were having so many children were in prison, et cetera, they thought it was going to be about race and blacks, but they found that it was not quite about race and blacks. It was among blacks that there was 25% of the children growing up in African-American families did not have their dads. Well, that was 25% children growing up in fatherless communities and fatherless homes in 1965. Today, in Caucasian homes, 32% of children are growing up without their dads. And in African-American homes, 75% are growing up without their dads. So you can get some, and it's within these demographics of dad-deprived children that the problems are occurring. I began to look at, when I wrote The Boy Crisis, I researched 10 major causes of the boy crisis. And I was, planning my initial book, the book, to be based on these 10 causes. But increasingly, I saw that the core hub cause was the dad deprivation. And then other causes like there being few male teachers in schools, those were important causes, but they were secondary. Environmental causes were secondary. Mental health causes were outgrowths of the dad deprivation. They weren't the cause. That the cause was more, the hub of the problem was in the dad deprivation.
Now, you talk about the purpose void in the book, and I found that to be so remarkable in a number of ways, and we'll get into that. But what do you mean by the purpose void?
Historically, boys have had two senses of purpose. One was they were given social bribes to be called heroes, to be willing to be disposable in war. And so if you were, if your son was, a nice, strong guy, you maybe encouraged him to become a Marine to fight against the Nazis in World War II. And, and then if he died, you didn't want him to die. But if he did die, he knew he'd be considered a hero. The second group, the second sense of purpose was to be the sole breadwinner. You had to learn, and I certainly learned this when I was a kid. I was good as a writer when I was in high school, and my father made it really clear to me. Like, Warren, yes, you're a good writer, but do not, you can't become a writer because only about 1% of writers find a publisher. Most people, and if you can't find a publisher, you're not going to find a wife. So I said, well, what's the proof of that? And he said, well, look at Zelda Fitzgerald. She loved F. Scott Fitzgerald, but she made it real clear to F. Scott Fitzgerald that until you have your first best-selling book, we don't get married. And so there were enough hints of that made me realize that that I had to not do what I wanted to do. I couldn't do what my passion was, because if my passion was to be a writer or for other guys, a musician or an artist, that the word starving artist was around for a reason. So that was really clear to me. And so boys and men, we got the second signal, which is if you want to be eligible as a dad, you have to do something that's going to pay, that's going to have predictable, dependable income. So not because you love it, but because that's what it will take to support, to attract a woman who wants to have children and to support the wife and children if she decides that she wants to be full-time involved with the children or part-time involved with the children. So if they're driving it, if you call it an Uber, the chances are fairly good that about 90% of the Uber drivers are male. They're not doing this because it's about power. They're doing this to be able to either to earn enough money to do the things that they need to do in their life.
And something that struck me culturally, to any of the first world nations, there was a specific term, two fathers who basically worked themselves to death.
Yes, absolutely. There's in Japan, there is the death from overwork. The name for that is karoshi, K-A-R-O-S-H-I. So the wisdom of the youth in Japan is that the normal pathway of becoming a man to try to get to the top of the ladder is a way of committing suicide or doing death from overwork. And so that's, and that's one of the reasons that many of the young people are not motivated, because, they know that that traditional pathway to being a man was that men have learned to define power as feeling obligated to earn money that someone else spends while they die sooner. And the young Japanese males are saying, no way. I'm out of that. That's not a ball game I want to play. And they recognize that that isn't not about power. But I want to go back to something that you asked about the purpose void. I was mentioning two senses of purpose that boys traditionally had, which was the warrior or sole breadwinner. Today, we have fewer men that are needed in war, and we have fewer men that need to be sole breadwinners because women are helping to share that burden. Therefore a purpose void for many men. And the purpose void is actually a wonderful thing if you have a father and a mother that can help guide you to discovering your sense of purpose and then help you to have the discipline to achieve that sense of purpose. But when there's both a purpose void and a dad void, that the boy does not get well guided usually to have that sense of purpose. Moms often are very good at helping the boy discover their talents, but what is missing often without dad-style parenting added to mom-style parenting is the discipline. Dads are far more likely to do boundary enforcement. Boundary enforcement encourages postponed gratification. Postponed gratification gives boys the discipline to be able to fulfill their dreams. If a boy has a lot of dreams or a girl has a lot of dreams, but they don't have the discipline to fulfill it, each time they go about trying to get their dreams, he wants to be an actor, he wants to be a basketball player, he wants to be, you know, top-notch in school, valedictorian. He continues without the discipline, he continues to fail. After a while, he becomes afraid to dream. So he notices that he's not getting good feedback from his teachers, from his parents are not proud of him in the way they are maybe of his sister or some kid down the block. And the boy feels a bit ashamed. When it comes to boy-girl time, the boy starts feeling like, gee, you know, the girls are not dating. They're dating all the winners and, you know, the football players, the student body presidents and so on. They're not dating the losers like me. So he can't get any satisfaction sexually. So he begins to withdraw into porn because porn is access to a variety of attractive women without fear of rejection at a price he could afford. And so he starts. But the problem with porn, aside from the moral issues, is that he becomes addicted. His dopamine only becomes stimulated by increasing amounts of doses of more risky behavior with females. And so then he gets to the actual first real life woman, and he begins to find that that real life woman is feeling treated like an object, because she is. And so she withdraws from him. He feels rejected, returns to porn, and the whole cycle continues. And in the meantime, the anger that festers in this boy, if he's a single mom boy, he's usually sensitive. And he then becomes very sensitive to being rejected and very angry that girls are not interested in sensitive boys. They're interested in the performers and the winners, not the sensitive boys who are the losers, from many girls' perspectives. And so these types of things create this festering hostility.
Two things you brought up there. One, you know, this role of the risk taker, the warrior, and even the breadwinner is dying. It's evaporating. It's not something that is available to us as society advances with automation. There's less and less risk out there in the workforce. And on top of it, you're seeing pay become more and more equitable. And there are relationships where oftentimes the male is not the sole breadwinner, let alone the one who is bringing home the most money. So that's creating this void. And then the other thing I want to touch on is, and obviously we're here in Hollywood, so, you know, Hollywood is not doing us a service either in their portrayal of the hopeless, hapless dad who doesn't really have a role other than being the bumbling idiot. And obviously, you know, that's carrying on in our minds as, okay, that's the role that a dad has, which clearly is not serving the boys or the girls that they're raising.
Yes, this is a perfect lose-lose situation. Children that have father involvement are far less likely to be obese. They're far less likely to have ADHD. They're far less likely to do worse in every single academic area. They're far less likely to be depressed, commit suicide. The suicide rate of boys and girls at the age of 9 is equal. But between 10 and 14, the suicide rate of boys is twice that of girls. Between 15 and 19, four times that of girls. Between 20 and 25, 4.5 to 5 times that of girls. And I could go on and on with the other variables as well. The mass shooters, 90% likely to be dad-deprived boys. The prisoners, 93% males. But of that 93% males, more than 90% are dad deprived. The ISIS recruits, studies of both male and female ISIS recruits find that both the males and the small percentage of females are dad deprived. And so, you know, there's the amount of things that happen when a boy or girl is dad deprived are enormous. Girls suffer in most of these areas too, but girls have two or three things that boys do not have. They have a same-sex role model, and they have much more societal permission to ask for help, to cry, to express feelings that boys do not have. The senses of purpose that boys had in the past was training to be a hero by being disposable. Well, that created heroic intelligence. Heroic intelligence was preparation for a short life. Health intelligence is preparation for a long life, preparation to share your feelings, say what's bothering you, not do it often, taking the best of masculinity and femininity. You learn to tough it out with as the masculine part of you, but you also learn that when the going gets tough, the tough get going sometimes, and other times when the going gets tough, the tough get going to a therapist other times. And you learn that right balance. That's the balance that keeps you alive, functional, and successful the most. But we haven't taught boys emotional skills, because what we've depended upon boys in the past for is to be willing to provide money, do what they needed to do to tough it out, or to be willing to die and be disposable. And so those things have created heroic intelligence, not the emotional intelligence and the physical health intelligence that are that will be needed and desired by girls and women in the future. Because the more money women make, the more they're going to want emotional intelligence from men, in addition to about equal amounts or greater amounts of money.
And that's what we were talking about before we kicked this off. You know, for the last 12 years, we've been working mostly with male clients. We just opened our doors to women. And we found that for many of our clients, the first time they realize they're lacking in this emotional intelligence is when they're dating and when they're trying to connect with the opposite sex. And now this emotional intelligence is just going to become more and more in demand.
Yes.
Hey, Art of Charm listeners. I'm excited to share a new podcast I've been absolutely binging. Winning is an everyday mindset, and Craig Robinson and John Calipari are here to help. On Ways to Win podcast, Craig and Coach Cal use their on-court wisdom to solve your off-court problems. Whether it's trouble at home or a workplace dilemma, the coaches will help you find a winning formula for success. You'll hear from prominent athletes, business leaders, and celebrities who reveal insights that made them into the leaders they are today. And don't miss President Obama sharing how he deals with pressure by projecting confidence, believing in your team, and taking criticism. Listen to Ways to Win wherever you get your podcasts.
Over the last 17 years, we have launched our fair share of online courses, coaching programs, and finding the right platform has always been a challenge.
They say if you do what you love, you never work a day in your life. But if you're an entrepreneur, you know the hard work that comes with it. That's why you need Kajabi. Kajabi makes it easy to run your entire online business from one platform, so you can focus on what you love, creating.
Kajabi is the ultimate all-in-one platform that helps creators and entrepreneurs build successful online businesses by unlocking predictable recurring revenue.
No matter your niche, Kajabi makes it easy to turn your skills, passions, and experiences into enriching online courses, exclusive membership sites, subscription podcasts, thriving communities, personalized coaching, and more.
The best part? Kajabi doesn't cut into your revenue because everything is owned and controlled by you. So keep 100% of what you earn.
And with Kajabi, you also get robust analytics, easy payment options, email marketing tools, and customizable website templates, all built in.
You don't even need a huge audience to make sustainable income. There are thousands of creators on Kajabi making six and seven figures with less than 50,000 followers.
Right now, Kajabi is offering a free 30-day trial to start your business if you go to kajabi.com/charm. That's KAJABI.com/charm.
Go to kajabi.com/charm and join the creators and entrepreneurs who have made over $7 billion.
One question that sort of popped into our mind as we were prepping for the show that's always so fascinating. And, you know, obviously we live in California and gun laws are very strict here. And without getting into the politics of gun laws, every time we talk about these mass shootings, you know, it seems like the media focuses on the weapon of choice and does not focus on the perpetrator and what led to that place that he would choose to make that decision. And oftentimes when we talk about the perpetrator, it's he's psychotic, he's a sociopath, he has all these mental illness. Why is it that we're not confronting the root of the issue here that you've been on the forefront, and why is the media not paying attention to this?
Yes, I think it is so much easier to sort of look at the fact that, you know, that the boy has a mental illness. Well, duh, you know, that's taught, you know, it's redundant, you know, if a person, you know, kills people, they're going to have a mental illness. That's what that's about. It's just one manifestation of it. If we wanted to stop mass shootings, we would do two things. One is because more than 90% of the mass shooters are dad deprived, we would focus on getting dads involved. If you look at the mass shooters, you know, we often say it's about guns, it's about family violence, it's about violence on TV or in the media. Well, women have the same access to the same guns, the same access to the same family values, the same access to the same TV, the same access to everything else. They live in the same home, but women are not doing the shootings. Boys are. And it's not all boys that are doing the shootings, obviously. It is more than 90% of the time dad-deprived boys. There's two easy solutions to about 99% of the mass shootings. One is dads in. The other is guns out. And that accounts for almost all the mass shootings. In Australia, there used to be about as many mass shootings per capita as there were in the as there was in the United States. They got guns out to a large degree, and nothing else changed, but they almost eliminated the mass shootings. In the United States, we know now that the mass shootings are among boys who are dad deprived, and there is much easier access to guns than there is in any other place in the world. And we have more mass shootings than any other place in the world, I feel, for those two reasons. And so the solution is right in front of us.
Yeah, it seems like a massive blind spot that we have culturally, politically right now to not pay attention to that.
Yes, and you know, boys who don't have their testosterone channeled constructively, usually by a dad and mom together, will almost invariably channel their testosterone destructively. One of the dynamics between moms and dads is roughhousing. Dads will tend to sort of take the three kids and throw them on the couch, and the game is, okay, the three of you, your job is to jump onto my back and turn me over and pin me down in a wrestling match before I pin the three of you down together. Okay, yeah, we got it, Dad, we got it. But mom is saying to herself, oh, okay, now be good. The kids are having fun. You don't want to interfere. You don't want to be, you know, you want your dad to get involved, but she's also fearing that sooner or later there's going to be somebody crying or somebody going to get hurt. Well, she's only about 99.9% likely to be right. Sooner or later, somebody gets hurt and is crying. And so now mom's thinking to herself, all right, now dad's going to learn his lesson. He won't do this roughhousing anymore. But dad doesn't learn his lesson. He says to the children, Jimmy or Jane, you can't stick your elbow in your sister's eye in order to win at roughhousing. You've got to, you know, do it. You can use leverage. You can fake the person out. You can do this and that, but not this. Okay, Dad, okay, we got it. Okay, now go back and try again. And so the kids go back and they violate what psychologists call getting emotional intelligence under fire. They all want to agree with what Dad is suggesting or requiring. But when they get excited, they forget about their sisters and brothers' needs, and they just push and get to what they want to do. So then Dad stops, if he's a good dad, and says, okay, I warned you. Now there's no more roughhousing. Oh, we forgot, Dad, we forgot. Nope, no more roughhousing until tomorrow night. So mom is looking at this and going, wait a minute. You didn't learn the lesson. The kids cried. Then you told them what to do. Then they didn't get it again. And you're still roughhousing and promising more tomorrow night. What Dad doesn't explain is that tomorrow night is what it's all about. Tomorrow night, he says the same thing. And if the children violate the agreement, there's no roughhousing tomorrow night. But usually the children tomorrow night don't violate the agreement because the children have learned that when they don't consider their sisters or brothers' needs, they don't get their needs met. They don't get to do what they want to do. They lose what they want. So now the studies of children roughhousing with dads show children are more likely to be empathetic. Well, I've never heard a dad say to a mom, I'd like you to let me roughhouse because this will teach the children empathy. And if he did, it's like, what? Empathy seems pretty counterintuitive to roughhousing. But you can see it's not the roughhousing per se that creates the empathy. It's the roughhousing combined with the boundary enforcement and the requirement that there will be no more roughhousing if you don't think of somebody besides yourself. The same with the assertiveness versus aggressiveness. The second or third time around, the kid may say, well, you know, I didn't push him or her. And then dad is able to say, that's what pushing is. That's where the assertiveness became aggressiveness. Not in those words, but you can't push that way, that hard, that type of thing. Well, mom can say that intellectually 100 times. Dad can say it intellectually 100 times, but the child doesn't learn it until she or he experiences it. That's what teaches the difference between being assertive and aggressive. So now we have the data to show that children who roughhouse form a bond with their dad. The bond allows the dad to set the boundaries and enforce the boundaries without there being resentment, because that bond is so strong. Kids know that they're going to go back to the roller coaster, and they also and get the boundaries enforced, and they're going to have a lot of fun. So they want to play. They want to play the game with dad. This is just one example of 9 different styles that dads have versus moms have. And what I'm encouraging dads to do, I'm not blaming dads for not sharing this with moms. I don't know of any parenting magazine that explains this. But on the other hand, I'm not blaming moms either, because moms can't hear what dads don't say.
Well, this one piece with the roughhousing and how it is creating this bond and building this respect between the father and the children. Look at the building blocks that this puts together for them. Now the child goes to school and they're in the schoolyard, and now they're trying to put together diplomacy in order to put some games together, to play some football, to play some soccer. And with those skills, they're able to put teams together, set the rules, have this game. And now these children are forming these bonds on their own, and now they feel safe because they have the acceptance and the approval and the attention of their peers. And now they're feeling good. We were just talking about this, of diplomacy and this leadership and this emotional intelligence. And they're not even finding out about this. Sometimes it comes to dating. Sometimes it's even later to when they're finally in a position at work and in a career on the top of a team, and they're unable to put it together.
They're lost. And the other part that we were laughing about, you know, both of us grew up with our dads, single dad for me, dad divorced, mom was out of the picture, she was abusive. And, you know, Johnny chose to live with his dad after divorce. And outside of that angle, we also developed this resilience, right? This mm-hmm. grit that dad enforces. And I always felt that, you know, if there was a boo-boo, if I went to any of the women in my household, I would be treated in a much different manner yes. than if I had a boo-boo with dad. And, you know, that style of parenting is often frowned upon, right? Dads get yelled at for these behaviors, saying, what's your problem? Why are you letting them beat up on each other, hurt each other, and not understand the underlying importance of these activities to build the grit, resilience, and diplomacy and leadership that it takes to excel in your career. So now we're raising children who are getting to a place of they're feeling lost. The parents are exasperated. And often they don't share in the dynamic at all. They're getting upset with each other. And we talked about violence. We're also seeing at the other end with the drug epidemic and the opioid crisis and, mm-hmm. and children just withdrawing from society and not having any purpose or meaning in their life.
You're absolutely right. And if you take it right back to what you were talking about, John and AJ, about the building blocks. The building blocks that we just described with the roughhousing, you take those building blocks to school, and you know, who are the kids going to like more at school? The person who shows some empathy, the person who knows the difference between being assertive versus aggressive, or the one that is not empathetic, that is self-centered, that is aggressive? And of course, it's a rhetorical question. Children will associate with children that are more empathetic, and that children that know the difference between being assertive versus aggressive. And so therefore, those children end up having more friends. Children with more friends end up with better social skills, emotional skills, and there's a whole cycle of, you know, building on that friendship, but they're much more likely to be less depressed. They're more likely to sort of feel good about themselves, succeed in school, have the energy to complete things if they have the postponed gratification as well. And so you have a much happier child. The withdrawal, the anger, the hood over the head, the taking of drugs, the being able to be seduced into doing something destructive. And so we, as I said before, the Moynihan report, we saw this, the Coleman report, we saw this. Over and over again, we have seen this effects of dad deprivation, and yet no one is paying attention.
Warren, the statistics, the data, the research, it's in, and there's a problem. And as we move forward with the technology that we have and with everything that we know and the work that you've done, what have you seen and where that we can do to help this situation?
Well, before we get there, I just wanted to tackle, because we lightly touched on this with the porn problem that you were talking about earlier, but this is not just porn. We're looking at this dopamine system that is being manipulated, and a lot of us aren't even aware of it. It's invisibly happening with these devices in our pocket and all of these distractions that are wiring our brains for behavior that is not healthy. And you talk about this in the book, that this inhibited dopamine function in the brain leads to a cascade of issues for boys and girls. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about that, because I know it's been something that Johnny and I have talked about a lot on the show. Yeah. And I don't think enough people realize it.
Absolutely. John Gray, who is the author of the book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, he did 5 chapters in the Boy Crisis book on ADHD and how to prevent it. And he's and without using drugs. The drugs are just, it's like they're like crutches that many of the drugs are very similar to cocaine and other really negative drugs that will solve the problem for a while, but will increase the problem and after a while with the, for the reasons you just mentioned. What can be done, though, is 5 chapters worth of solutions to this, mostly ideally preventive solutions, but also you can reverse ADHD. And exercise is the number one way of reversing ADHD. But that doesn't mean suggesting to your children that they exercise. It means requiring your children to exercise. Some type of team sport. Learn how to interact with other children. Get your body physically moving. Well, for girls, that's important. For boys, that's even more important, because boys' brains are more receptive. They're more settled down. They're more cooperative when they have physical activity. The other thing that's so important for the correct dopamine balance is family dinner nights. We've all heard that the children that do better are ones that have a lot of family dinner nights. But I've seen that there's a refinement of that. There are family dinner nights, and there's also family dinner nightmares. And so as I began to start interviewing families, I began to see that there's about 5 things that families do that lead to family dinner nights being extremely constructive. And if they're not done, they can become extremely destructive. And so one of those, for example, is knowing how to make sure that there are no electronics at the table. Some parents come up to me and say, Dr. Farrell, my children, they always want electronics at the table. I don't know how to get rid of them. Well, I know something immediately when the parent says that, which is that the parent is in charge of the children, that the children are in charge of the parent, not that the parent is in charge of the children.
We're laughing just thinking about that. If we told our dads, no, the iPad stays at the dinner table.
There's no way.
Talk about a boundary.
Well, to even go along with that, my dad had this thing and I was laughing about this, Warren, because during summer vacation, my dad didn't care where I was, what I was doing. As long as I was out and skateboarding, he was fine. But if he came home and I was playing video games in front of he would find chores for me to do. So I learned very quickly that let's find some
where
games.
The reward is. It's not in front of the computer.
So that was how he went about making sure that I was outside playing and not behind the computer screen.
My dad hid the Sega Genesis.
Yeah.
I was all excited. I invited my friends over. I had the Mortal Kombat code so I could see all the blood and violence. And I go into my bedroom with my buddies and there's no Sega. And I'm like, what the hell? And my dad's like, no, you've been playing this too much. Get outside, grab a basketball, do something. But I find that you know, parents right now are so protective of their children being injured and getting mm-hmm. into this rough housing and going outdoors is almost anathema to yeah. being a parent these days. It's like, no, we want to keep our kids close and monitored. Save. We need this device on them so I know where they are. And it's just fostering this dopamine dysfunction that we're talking about.
There is this information, this way of thinking about what I call checks and balance parenting. The children that grow up the best are not ones that have just dads or just moms. They're ones that have an active tension between dads and moms around how much protection, how little protection. When can my son or daughter climb the tree? If so, they can. If they can climb the tree at a younger age than mom would like, what type of protection do they need when they climb the tree? Do they need dad out there to sort of make sure they don't fall and really hurt themselves? Does dad need to be out there with or without a cell phone? When we talk about these issues on family dinner night, what makes that family dinner night into a family dinner nightmare? And one of the things that makes that family dinner night into a family dinner nightmare is not having each person in the family be fully listened to, no matter what their opinion, no matter what they say, no matter how they say it. The first job of every family member is to allow each person in the family, children and parents, to feel completely heard by the other one.
Now, it is Father's Day. In celebration of Father's Day, what can we do as parents, whether it's dad, mom, or to support, obviously, growing children that are healthy? And I know for a lot of us, we're starting out as parents, we're thinking about children, and we want to be the best parents. Maybe we've learned some things from our parents that we don't want to do. How can we show up and be better parents?
The number one thing that parents can do is learn how to handle personal criticism without becoming defensive. I started teaching couples communication courses around the country because I found that when, the boy crisis was oftentimes a phenomenon of divorce. Divorce was a phenomenon of the mother and father not being able to handle criticism without becoming defensive. Therefore, it made it unsafe for their partner to be able to share their real feelings and concerns. And so both sexes felt, both mom and dad felt like they were walking on eggshells. And so that would either lead to a divorce, or it would lead to a legal divorce, or it would lead to a psychological divorce, or it would lead to a minimum security prison marriage, which is very sad for everybody. And yeah. So I started teaching that, but it's important I teach it to adults. It's very important for parents to have that because most of the time children mimic the style of communication that their parents that their parents do. That's pretty common sense. But it's also important for us to be teaching that to our first, second, and third grade children, both boys and girls. So the bullies that see that are picking on a kid, when they see what the feelings and the real full personality of the child that they're picking on and how that made them feel, they stop bullying to a much greater degree. When the bully is listened to as well, he or she doesn't feel as insecure and therefore bullies less. The bully and the bullied have in common, both of them have low self-esteem. They have a lot of characteristics in common. And as they listen to each other in first, second, and third grade, where this has been done in Denmark, they find that there's a significant reduction in bullying in school and also other dysfunctional behavior. And there's an increase in emotional intelligence that you were talking about before, AJ, as being so crucial, not only to getting along with children, but eventually in male-female relationships or in same-sex relationships. Emotional intelligence is probably the most important single skill you can get. And the fact that we're teaching, I have learned far more from teaching the couples communication courses than I ever learned, even though I was good enough at math to be teaching math in the eighth grade, but I haven't learned nearly as much from math as I have from couples communication skills and communication skills.
Absolutely. And we love to wrap every episode with a challenge for our listeners. And with it being Father's Day, we love the exercise you outline in the beginning of your book, inquiring about your dad's glint.
Yes.
Could you walk our listeners through this exercise so that they could do it as well?
I can do a mini version of that. Absolutely. So if you're listening to this, just close your eyes for a moment and just visualize a time in your life when you saw your dad with a glint in his eye. By glint in his eye, I mean he wasn't worried about lecturing you, correcting you, telling what you were doing right or wrong. He didn't seem to be worried about anything. For those few minutes, maybe he was telling a joke he told a dozen times before, or a story he told a dozen times, because he knew that when he told that story or that joke, he would feel like people would laugh at him, and that relaxed him, and he knew exactly how to tell it. Or maybe he golfed, or maybe he fished, or maybe he sang in a chorus, or maybe he played a musical instrument, or maybe you didn't ever see that glint in his eye, but you saw it in a picture of your father when he was just on a honeymoon with your mom, and the glint in his eye you could see in that picture. Maybe you didn't know your dad. So if you didn't know your dad, imagine what might have created the glint in his eye. Compare that with what your father actually did for a living. So if you're saying, well, my father, you know, he had a glint in his eye when he cooked turkey for Thanksgiving. So he became a chef. So he did for a profession what created the glint in his eye. No, that's not the same. When he was cooking for Thanksgiving, the glint in his eye came because he was cooking for his family. When he was a chef, he was cooking on Thanksgiving and he was away from his family. What you do as a profession, you do what needs to be done. You don't do what creates a glint in the eye. And most of our dads, when the children were born, gave up the glint in their eye, the true glint, and did something that they liked doing less. So as you look at what your dad did, on Father's Day, think about what created the glint in his eye, and maybe ask your dad if he's still alive, Dad, what created the glint in your eye, and direct him toward helping him discover his own glint. That's the gift you can give your dad on Father's Day. If you want to know more about how to direct that and how to work out what a glint is and how to distinguish that and how to ask that question. So I have a whole section on that, as you know, in the Boy Crisis.
And where can our audience find more about the book and everything that you're working on in these fantastic workshops?
If money is an issue, then I'd suggest Amazon, which has it at a 30-some-odd% discount. So if you're a guy or a woman who drives a lot or works out at the gym, it's in Audible form. It's also now in paperback or hardcover. So Amazon is definitely the least expensive place to get it. If you have a bit more income and you can afford to buy it at a local store, support your local bookstore for the Boy Crisis book. And if you want to know more about it, you can look at warrenferrell.com. That's my website.
Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for me too. You guys are just wonderful.
What an episode with Dr. Warren Farrell.
Yeah, I've been looking for that for months. I recently had finished reading The Boy Crisis, and I was amazed because there's so much stuff. There's so much data and research that's gone into that book, but yet no one wants to talk about it. And then he has had a career and persevering through of carrying this message to get some attention for it so we can have this conversation. And it's been difficult for Warren, but it's obvious you can tell through this conversation of how important this is to him and how much he cares. And, you know, there's a reason why we should be caring.
Well,
because
yeah.
But boys who hurt us. And so this is the reason why we all need to pay attention to this, because we all have these young men in our lives who need this direction.
And he even talks about just the importance of having both parents involved.
Yes.
And that influences both the girls and the boys. Obviously, the yes. boy crisis is pressing. And I know for us, you know, anecdotally, we have been on the front line, so to speak,
yeah.
of this crisis, working with clients who come from single parent households, who have been protected, mm-hmm. who haven't built the diplomacy, the emotional intelligence through the rough housing and the interaction with strong male role models in their lives. And all of a sudden, they're struggling in their career. They're struggling to make friends. They're struggling in their dating life. All the things we talk about here on the show.
Well, we're now at a place where health intelligence and emotional intelligence need to replace hero intelligence. Because as he was saying, that we're now at a place where we're looking for the long haul. And, I even have friends who say, had I known I would have lived this long, I would have treated myself better, right? It's like
health intelligence.
And as we move forward, you want to be there for your children. As we move forward, you want to be there to create this legacy. And then as we move forward, you want to be a positive influence in your community. If we expect society and civilization to continue to advance.
Now, I know we celebrated Father's Day last weekend, but reach out to your dad. Find out about that glint. What a fantastic challenge to end the episode. Let us know what you enjoyed about the episode. You can send us our thoughts by going to theartofcharm.com/questions. Where can they email us, Johnny?
Yes, you can email us at questions@theartofcharm.com. You can also find us at social media at The Art of Charm. Also, I am there and AJ is there. AJ is there at AJ Harbinger and I am there at AOC Johnny.
Next week, we are really excited to be bringing on the one and only Michael Harrell, here at The Art of Charm, who works behind the scenes so hard to prep us for all these amazing guests and interviews and shows. He himself has gone through an amazing transformation. We're going to talk about that. He'll be joining us to answer your questions about transformation and personal development. So be sure to tune in next Monday.
Well, and also to go along with that, he heads up our core confidence program. That is amazing. And I'm excited for everyone to get to experience what we get to experience every week.
If you can do us a favor here at The Art of Charm and the entire crew, head on over to iTunes and rate this podcast. It would mean the world to us. 5 stars. Tell us a little bit about what you love about the show. You can send us your thoughts by heading to theartofcharm.com/questions. The Art of Charm podcast is produced by Chris Olin and Michael Harrell.
This show is recorded at Cast Media Studios in sunny downtown Hollywood. Engineered by Danny Luber and Bradley Denham.
All right, we will catch you next week. Have a great weekend.
See you guys. You're a bad boy. You're